discovering our Buddha nature. You know, discovering our Buddha nature. Think of a phrase that captured, you know, what I thought the concept of Buddha nature was, you know, for each one of us in a very simple, easily understood way. And the phrase came to my mind. All of you have thought this phrase. I know I have, you know, when I was about 5 or 6 years old, especially when I was getting scolded for being a naughty boy. And the thought would come, if people really knew me, they would really love me. They would really love me if they really knew who I was. And I'm sure you all had that thought, right? I mean, whenever you get into an argument or a disagreement, and you think to yourself, well, if they really knew me, if they knew the real me, they would love me. You know, they wouldn't hate me or criticize me or beat me up, you know. Because in our heart of hearts, you know, we know we're good people, right? We know there's a basic goodness with us. You know, we may come across as being, you know, rude or surly or insensitive, but our intentions are always good. And I don't think there's any situation where a person's intentions are consciously bad. You know, the problem is in the translation of those intentions to other people. So if people really knew me for who I really was, yeah, they would really love me. I mean, they wouldn't have to hate me or criticize me or abuse me or beat me up. Well, that phrase sort of came to my mind. You know, it's almost as if I was really getting to know these people. They were opening their hearts and talking about their deepest fears and thoughts and emotions. And all of a sudden, you know, the facades were gone, and I was listening to a real person, and I could feel that deep sense of metta, that deep sense of love, connection to each individual person that I'm speaking with. And sometimes I was doing more speaking and sometimes I was doing just listening. But that's okay. You know, there was a connection that was made. And I could feel a deep sense of love, metta, and connection. And I hope that those who participated in the sessions today might have felt the same thing too. Because in many cases there was a really deep sharing, and I was moved to tears, and in some instances, you know, so were the people in the interviews. So these were very powerful exchanges, and so I just want to acknowledge that, and acknowledge the deep connection, you know, that I felt with all the people that, you know, I had a chance to speak with today. And the other phrase that comes to mind is that I'm going to be speaking about what people have said today. I'm trying, about what my effort is to consolidate, you know, their comments into various, you know, sort of subject areas, so as not to refer to any particular person, you know. So you might hear something, you know, similar to what you said, but in most cases, you're not the only person who said it. You know, the reason why I selected certain things was because it was said by several different people. So obviously it constitutes a sort of theme, you know, that's kind of arising out of, you know, these interactions. But just in case, I'd like to invoke what is called the prayer of forgiveness. And this is actually a very powerful prayer. If you like, I can write it down. It's actually used quite a lot, you know, in rituals and ceremonies. But the prayer goes something like this. If by word, thought, speech, or deed I have offended anyone, please forgive me, honored ones, who are in wisdom and compassion strong. I freely forgive anyone who may have offended me. I freely forgive myself. So, nothing personal. but I think what was shared in many respects was extremely powerful and extremely moving and extremely relevant for the practice. Now, what I thought I would do is I made the effort to consolidate the comments into a series of issues or a series of categories, if you will. So what I'm going to do is sort of run down the categories and then go back through the interviews and sort of pick out, you know, particular points that I thought were particularly solid. There was a clear sense of progress. You know, everybody is getting better. You know, Monday was pretty rough. Tuesday was, you know, getting better. And today, for those who sat through the morning or some of the sessions in the morning, was feeling a notable sense, a noticeable sense of improvement. So I just want to congratulate everyone, you know, for your sincerity of effort and your commitment. Because as long as there's that sincerity of effort and commitment, you will get better. You know, it's just the practice. This is the way the practice goes. So some of the issues that came up, one was the issue of groundedness. Groundedness. Okay. Now, what this means is the sense of solidity of self and how this was affected by standing meditation. Standing meditation came out as a very, very powerful exercise, much more than I expected. And I was delighted because standing meditation is a very powerful meditation. You know, it's often, you know, overlooked because it's so simple, right? But standing meditation, people were really, a lot of people were using standing meditation, both at the beginning of the walking meditation or interspersed through the walking meditation, or as a meditation in itself. So if you were, say, walking and you were sort of losing your attention or getting distracted, just stopping, you know, reinforces that sense of groundedness and stillness. And some people were just doing standing meditation for 10, 15 minutes, you know, before they even would start. And the noting process in standing meditation is often much more vivid and much more powerful. Because while in sitting meditation, you're noting your breath, which is, you know, fairly subtle. But in standing meditation, you're noting predominant sensations, you know, so, you know, the pressure on the bottom of your feet, or, you know, the tightness of the belt, or your clothing, or the wind blowing across your skin, or, you know, it's much more tangible, or, you know, the energy moving through your body. So, you know, there's more to, you know, observe, to note in the body. So it's actually a very powerful, you know, form of meditation in itself. Another thing was the issue of guidance. Guidance in the sense of, in two ways. Some people felt they needed guidance because they were feeling a sense of rejection, abandonment, groundlessness. You know, it's like it was hard for them to move into the practice on their own, and they missed the guidance. They missed the, you know, the concentration practice guidance, the mindfulness practice guidance, you know, the metta guidance. You know, all of a sudden, you know, oh, I got 45 minutes, you know, what am I going to do? And so there was a kind of, you know, reliance on the guidance as a way to carry, you know, through the process. And some of that comes out of a sense of groundlessness and abandonment. So it's deeply rooted, you know, in a psychic, you know, kind of issue, a psychic problem. So in one point, you know, the bringing out of that relationship was very, very powerful. You know, it's so that. So it is a matter of seeing that 45 minute as a moment of your independent choice of your practice and what you do in the time that's allotted for you. So it's an invitation to independence. It's an invitation to agency. It's independence. It's an invitation to choice. And so this is a, you know, it's a very powerful, you know, it's like a baby taking their steps or learning how to swim. going out into the open space and taking control, you know, asserting oneself, you know, in that space of silence, you know, without any support, just moving into that space. The other way of seeing guidance was in terms of, similar, in terms of moving you one through the process and giving support through the process, which is similar to what is done in the Tibetan traditions and some of the other, you know, Buddhist traditions. But I think the issue here for Vipassana or the Theravada, you know, tradition is that it is all about one's discovery of one's self in terms of one's own emotions, afflictive emotions, one's own attachments, afflictions, you know, aversions and, you know, delusions. So it's an inherently self, you know, examinatory kind of process. I mean, it's really about examining yourself. And so the whole process of concentration and mindfulness is really the vehicle, you know, through which that process occurs. So guidance in terms of moving people in particular places or creating particular mind states or anything like that is sort of different. Of course, you know, one can be guided in the doing of that, and the meditation instructions, you know, sort of have that purpose. But ultimately, it's about, you know, one's discovery of one's own self. Another issue that came up was psychic anguish. There was a fair amount of psychic anguish of different forms. Loss of a loved one, the death of a loved one. In one case, the recent death of a loved one. A family tragedy, unresolved relationships, you know, to family members who might have passed away, a sense of grief, a sense of loss, a sense of unresolvedness, you know, and the grief and the sadness that comes from that, and the distraction, you know, that arises in the meditation. You know, the mind is just very distracted because you just pulled away by, you know, feelings of sadness, grief, anguish, despair. And these are very, very powerful. And it's not easy to just note it and let it go, right? Because it keeps coming back. You know, it's pretty powerful and it's very intrusive. Now, in a case like that, several sort of points of advice are given. Of course, the first is, if you can, note it and let it go, you know, because what you're trying to do is maintain the stability of your focused awareness and concentration. And the point being that it's not that you don't want to deal with these issues, but the first order is to stabilize your concentration so that, you know, if grief comes, you can just get swept away with grief, right? And it's not, you don't have the stability of awareness to be mindful of the grief, to observe the grief, to experience the grief in a mindful way. See, this is the difference, rather than just being carried away by the grief, which is what most often happens, the grief or the sadness, right? So it's important to establish that stability of focus. So, you know, if you can, you know, note these feelings as they arise and let them go and come back to the breath. You know? And, you know, in the beginning, this also has to do with just general distraction of mind, right? Just thoughts come piling in. In the beginning, it might be really hard to do that, you know, because of the power of the thoughts as well as their frequency. But this is the practice. Just think of it this way. This is the practice. So just note it and let it go. Note it and let it go. Note it and let it go. And, you know, we've only been doing it for 3 days. You know, if you do this for 3 weeks or 3 months, you know, or 3 years or 30 years, eventually you get better at it. You know, it's a practice that goes on and deepens over time. So, you know, don't despair. You know, we've only been doing it for 3 days. So if you can, you know, just keep the focus and the concentration stable and focused, you know, try that first. If you cannot, and it just becomes completely overwhelming, then you just exercise mindfulness and you turn your attention to whatever it is that's arising and says, okay, whatever, you know, welcome to my guest house, you know, let's have a look, you know, what's going on here, you know. And with that sense of acceptance, that sense of inquiry, that sense of invitation, you know, sort of allowing it in and just investigating. So what's going on here? I mean, where did this come from? Why do I feel this way? Why does this person feel this way? Or what were the circumstances that led to this dysfunctionality or this lack of connection? And just, you know, as if you were a cold case detective, you know, analyzing a situation, just break it down. And what you're doing is you're actually untying what is called a karmic knot. This is a karmic knot, right? It's this karma just all kind of discombobulated like a Gordian knot. So allow your mind to simply start to untie these strands and say, okay, this is where this is coming from, this is where that's going, this is where that's going, and, you know, kind of unraveling this whole thing. You know, with a focused, almost analytical mind. And think of it that way as a problem to solve. So it's not, you're not identified with it. It's, oh, my grief over my, you know, this. But it's like, okay, this is what happened to me, so I want to understand it. I want to, you know, gain some perspective, you know, on my own personal experience. So you almost approach it as a, you know, as an analytical problem. Now the other thing is to truly learn compassion. So these are the two sides of it. One is understanding, you know, sort of, you know, kind of unraveling the karmic web. And the second part is compassion. And it's so, so important. You have to have compassion for yourself. And it's about yourself. You can have compassion for other folks, but I dare say it's 10 times more difficult to have compassion for yourself. Because you think, well, I should be okay. I should be, you know, the one, you know, forgiving and accepting and, you know, consolidating and empathizing. But, you know, basically you're just, you know, you're crying inside. And you're not acknowledging, you know, that pain that you're feeling. So compassion is really so, so important. And really, you know, I would really encourage you to bring the compassion prayer. And I would be happy to. Actually, I've got 3 versions of the compassion prayer. I have the one that we normally use, you know, may I be saved from all inner and outer harm, which is something that basically I created, you know, for our group. But there are other wordings for that, which I'd be glad to, you know, put and Xerox and make available. I thought to do that because I think it's really good to take this wording so that you can use it, you know, in your own compassion meditations. I also like to share one comment that one person made about this, which was so touching and so profound. And he was talking about the transition from concentration to mindfulness, right? We've been talking about, you know, developing the concentration and getting into deep, you know, getting into samadhi, neighborhood concentration, momentary concentration, so that the focus is, you know, concentration is stabilized, focused, and, you know, it's not just, you know, moving all over the place, so that when something begins to arise, you can begin to shift that focus, you know, very mindfully, you know, to what is arising, you know, with a mind of investigation, a mind of inquiry, a mind of analysis, basically, you know, just understanding what's arising. But what these comments touched on was the kind of psychological dimension of this process, and I thought it was very, very sensitive and very well articulated, so I wanted to kind of share that. And it's, you know, the whole psychology of noting and letting go, is really diametrically opposed to the psychology of acceptance and receiving, you know, allowing. So there's really a mental shift that occurs, you know, and it's far more, you know, far more significant than sometimes, you know, we give credit. So you're actually making a cognitive shift, you know, as you shift from concentration to mindfulness. There's an actual shift in the way you see phenomena, you know, a thought or a feeling or an emotion. So it's not letting it go anymore. It's like it's letting it be, letting it just arise, and letting your awareness, your conscious awareness, move into it, you know, in a kind of integrative, you know, sort of fashion. And, you know, letting the ego go and just moving into, of course, the assumption is that you're in a state of concentration, so your discursive mind is relatively quiet. And just allow yourself to flow into that phenomena. You're not manipulating it, you're not trying to make it better than it is or worse than it is or in any way, but you're just simply accepting it in as it is. And so the effort is not to dispel, you know, the emotion, but to get comfortable with it. Just a sense of comfort and ease. So I use the term allowing safe passage, you know, for your emotion into your conscious awareness. It's like, okay, the doors are open, you know, welcome. Come on in. And this is really Rumi's The Guest House, right? So it's this sense of allowing, the sense of ease, the sense of letting whatever arise to arise. And it's a kind of opening up rather than a pushing away. And this is really important. It's a whole different psychic kind of state. It's like, you know, a whole different gestalt, really. So it's this gestalt of acceptance, of allowance, and of inquiry. So I thought that was just very, very beautifully articulated, and I appreciated it very much. Now, the walking meditation, what I found, okay, well, both the walking and the standing was very, very interesting. This year, more than any of the previous years, there was a much greater appreciation for the walking and for the standing. And I was very gratified by that, because the walking and standing, you know, are very, very important adjuncts, you know, to sitting meditation. And actually, they're not adjuncts. They're equally important in terms of, you know, their contribution, you know, to the meditative process. And so a number of people spoke about the power of the cadence, you know, using the cadence, the counting, you know, like lifting, two, three, moving, two, three, placing, two, three. One person, you know, was using and gotten all the way up to the 12 count, you know. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 1, you know, that moving that way. And so that becomes a really strong foundation for developing this kind of flow, you know, this kind of concentration, sense of rhythm, a sense of cohesiveness in the movement. And it's really also a part of samadhi. You know, you're coming into samadhi. So it's a concentration practice, right? It's a concentration practice. As opposed to a mindfulness practice. And this was another interesting, you know, kind of dimension that arose in the comments. Because some people preferred watching the lifting, moving, placing. Lifting, moving, placing. So that's a more attentional, you know, process where you're looking at the various stages. And one person had actually subdivided the whole walking process down to the lifting of the heels, the lifting of the instep, the rising of the balls of the foot, you know, the touching of the toes, the little toe, the middle toe, up to the big toe, then the lifting of the big toe, the moving, and the placing of the heel, you know, the touching of the instep, then the balls of the feet, then 1, 2, 3, 4, the last big toe. I mean, that was amazing. I mean, talk about focused concentration. You know, to be able to break it down into those small increments. But that, of course, obviously is mindfulness, right? It's like, your ability to see this. So there was this interesting sort of dialectic between, you know, the flow, you know, and this process of, you know, the breaking down of each step into its, you know, finite components. So basically it comes down to, well, I think what you want to do is both, if you can. You know, so you want to have this sense of flow and, you know, sort of samadhi with that degree of, you know, sharp, mindful awareness. Now, the reason I say this is there's another dimension to this walking meditation which I haven't brought up, which I thought I should bring up today. And it's actually in the Sayadaw Usilananda essay as well as the Mahasi essay. And that is the watching of intention. Okay, so this is a mind-body thing. So for each, you know, the three steps, right, lifting, moving, placing, for each physical movement, there are two movements of the mind. There are two cognitive movements. There's a physical movement and two cognitive movements. So in the lifting of the foot, there's the intention to lift the foot, and there's the actual physical lifting of the foot. And then there's this moment of knowing that the foot is lifted. And then in the moving of the foot, there's the intention to move the foot, there's the moving of the foot, and then the knowing that the foot is moved. And then in the placing of the foot, there's the intention to place the foot, the actual placing of the foot, and then the knowing that the foot is placed. Now, of course, all of this happens in a nanosecond, you know, in about half a second. And we don't even think about this. But in fact, at the neural level, this is kind of happening, right? With each step, the mind just all these mind moments are happening. So all of this is happening in nanoseconds. So the classic exercise, and you know, that's the exercise that Mahasi describes in his essay, is to slow things down so that you actually see the movement of the mind, you know, intending to move, the movement, the knowing of the movement, lifting and intending to move, etc., etc. So actually what you're watching are 9 sort of nanoseconds, 9 moments of mind-body, or what I call nama-rupa, okay, in the process. So, of course, this is very, very refined. You know, it takes practice to really slow things down and see it in that, you know, in that fashion, with that degree of detail. But this is, you know, what Mahasi is describing. So as you progress in your walking meditation, you know, tomorrow we have 2 more days, you know, when the walking is getting really clear and smooth and, you know, sort of focused, see if you can just kind of sense, you know, intention, the movement, and the knowing of the movement, intention to, you know, etc. You know, kind of break it down. And in fact, on a larger scale, the exercise is to see this in everything we do, you know, intention to lift, the lifting, the knowing that the hand is lifting, intention to turn, turning, knowing that the head is turning, intention to look, seeing, knowing that one is seeing. So, you know, this is sort of how we actually function, you know, at the nanosecond, the microsecond level, but we don't. You know, we're not aware of it because we're unconscious of that, right? So we just go through life moving, you know, doing all the things we do automatically. So this whole process is the process of breaking this down so we start to see how the mind and body works, you know, literally, you know, at the sort of microscopic level. You know? So, and this is where we start to see nama-rupa. And of course, the whole idea here is that there is no body behind it. It's just these moments of intention, you know, action, awareness, intention, action, awareness. So the concept of no self, you know, this is the beginning of the understanding of the concept of no self. And the big one is compassion. The whole concept of compassion. And it came up in a number of different ways. Of course, one is, you know, psychic anguish. I mean, that's clear, it's obvious, you know, compassion. And there's clear suffering involved. But it also came up in another way, which was very interesting. And I have to confess, you know, it affected me too. And that is, you know, how we can get annoyed and irritated by the behavior of other people. And sometimes it has to do with, you know, people who are here in the meditation hall, right, during the meditation retreat. And, you know, people who are, you know, behaving in what we might regard as, you know, insensitive or, you know, sort of careless and, you know, not very considerate of other people. And so, and how we get upset, we get irritated, we get annoyed, right? Oftentimes the advice is, well, just have compassion for that person. You know, that person doesn't know what they're doing, or they don't know what they're doing. So, you know, just forgive them, let it go. You know, you don't have to deal with it. But actually, it's more important to have compassion for yourself. Why? Think about it, right? Because what's happening here? You know, I'm getting upset because I'm not getting what I want. Right? I'm not getting peace, quiet, serenity, you know, a respectful behavior or sensitivity and, you know, my expectations of how people should behave, you know, in the meditation hall, my expectations of a good behavior. I'm getting triggered. I'm the one getting triggered, not the person who's creating all the problems. And actually, several people mentioned this. So, you know, it comes down to craving, you know, craving and aversion. And what aversion is, 9 out of 10 times, aversion, you know, all the afflictive emotions we feel are all about not getting what we want. You know, whether it's jealousy, anger, rage, grief, fear, you know, think about it. It's usually about not getting what we want. You know, you want something, right? You want quiet. You want justice. You want peace. You want, you know, environmental quality, or, you know, you want, etc. It doesn't matter what you want. You know, it could be money, sex, and power, or it could be justice, peace, and equality. But if you have such a high expectation that you want this and you're not getting it, you're in suffering. See, it doesn't matter what it is you want, it's about the wanting. And this is why sometimes we mix up the whole notion of content, you know, for process, in the sense that, oh, I'm cool because, you know, I'm for democracy, I'm for freedom, I'm for wealth and human well-being and environmental this and that, you know, so I'm holier than thou, right? Because I'm for the good stuff, right? So I can judge those people who are terrorists or they're, you know, bad guys. Well, actually, I'm just as bad suffering as they are. And I don't see it because, you know, I'm stuck in the content of what I'm thinking. Oh, this is better, right? It's cleaner. It's more right, more morally justified. But in fact, I'm just as much to blame as the person I'm blaming. I'm the one who's in suffering. So the compassion that I have to feel is for myself. I have to learn to forgive myself for how I get triggered by my unmet expectations of other people. It's not about the other people, it's about me. And so this, you know, this is a real lesson to all of us in terms of whenever you get triggered, it's not just, you know, this is really, you know, this is an example, a metaphor of all of us in our lives. Whenever you get triggered, it's usually about not getting something you want. And if you can start to understand it that way, and it's like, oh, okay, it's like kindergarten. You know? Oh, okay, that's what I want. Okay, I get it. Right? So then it's like, oh, all right. You know, it's kind of like, oh, okay, I get it. Then you can You know, there's not only spaciousness, there's understanding, and then, you know, you can sort of laugh it off. In some cases, you know, it just disappears because of that understanding. But we don't realize, you know, we cover it over with our irritation, our anger, our rage, and we justify our moral righteousness, you know, in terms of blaming other people, in terms of how bad they are and the bad things they do, when we're the ones who are in suffering. You see? So this is something worth thinking about for all of us, you know, in terms of, you know, how we respond to issues. Of course, another one was sensory awareness. Those who were having, you know, making progress in the sitting were really making strong progress in the areas of sensory awareness. And that includes awareness of energy in the body, the sensations, sounds, tastes, you know, just general overall sensory awareness. And this, you know, this is what happens, you know, as the practice deepens. You do become more sensory, you know, your sensory awareness of the environment in all the six sense doors, you know, begins to open up. And there was one particularly funny story of one person who, you know, we went through our eating meditation demonstration yesterday, you know, when I was opening up the thermos bottle. And he felt so inspired, you know, so he went off in a corner, and turns out he brought a lunch, which was a Japanese-style bento, you know, with a piece of salmon and some rice and some pickled radish. And he opened up his bento and realized he forgot his chopsticks. So he didn't have anything to eat with, right? So he said, well, whatever. So he started digging in with his hands, right? And literally picking up the food and, you know, like touching the food and putting it in his mouth and, you know, holding the salmon and smelling it. And it was like this euphoric experience. And it was really, really humorous. I had to laugh. And he even had this, he had this radish, right? It was a pickled radish, and he didn't have a spoon, so he bit into the radish to make a little spoon, you know, so he used the radish to lift up the rice and put it in his mouth. So his problem-solving mode, you know. And I have to say, it was just, I have to laugh, it was so clever, you know. But it was just this huge aesthetic experience, and just eating rice and salmon and bento with his hands, right? So, yeah, you know, life can be just wonderful, you know, if you just allow yourself to open up to the beauty of the moment, you know, literally. Okay. The breathing thing was came up for a lot of people in many ways. One was, having said that, let me just say one point about walking. I forgot to mention it because this was very, I thought it was a very good point. One person had trouble walking because they didn't feel very steady and they kept stumbling. And so this person was very clever. She went into the hall on the other side where, you know, they have the pews lined up. And so she started to walk down between the pews so she could hold on to the back of the pews when she walked. And, you know, if there's anyone who has similar issues, you know, I thought that was a great idea. So, you know, you can walk by the pews and just use the pews, you know, to hold on to. But then eventually, as her walking progressed, you know, she was able to walk, you know, unassisted, and then is now, you know, walking outside without assistance. But if there are any, because I know there are other people who have issues walking with balance and coordination, so, you know, please feel free to, you know, to do that. But this also gets to the thing about deep breathing, and a number of people mentioned that the whole process of taking these big, deep breaths, you know, as we begin the practice, is really, really powerful because it just cuts through the overactive mind. It just, you know, literally, you know, pulls out, you know, pulls the rug underneath the mind, so that, you know, it allows you to settle really fast. And, you know, if you do about three or four of these breaths, you know, it really brings you down. So I think there's a real value, you know, in these deep breaths. Now, the rhythmic breathing also, a lot of people felt that the rhythmic breathing was very, very helpful, both abdominal breathing as well as, you know, upper body breathing. So, and it's used in different ways. You can start your meditation with the rhythmic breathing just to establish, you know, samadhi. Or if you're in the middle of meditation and you start to lag, you know, start to get sleepy and tired, then just use the rhythmic breathing to kind of, you know, pump yourself up again and get your attention up and your energy level up. So, you know, you can use it in different ways. It's like using standing meditation in the middle of walking meditation, you know, when you get a little distracted. Just stop and stand for about 30 seconds or a minute and then start walking again. So it reinforces and invigorates, you know, what you're doing. Now another one was various expressions of shame, inadequacy, self-criticism, self-abuse almost. You know, like, I can't do this, or if I do something wrong, I start criticizing myself, you know, I'm not doing it correctly. You know, why can't I do this correctly? What's my problem? You know, the self-criticism, the self-critical attitude. And so that's pretty, you know, I think important to address, because we all have those moments, you know, like, oh, am I supposed to do it this way or that way? And then I can't remember. And then, you know, like, oh, what's wrong with me? And, you know, you just start deflating yourself because of, you know, you're not doing it the right way. And, of course, this gets to the cardinal rule of the practice. You know, it's not what you do. It's your awareness of what you do. I mean, the phrase is, you know, it's not what you do, it's how you do it, which is true. But it's, in this case, it's your awareness of what you're doing. So, if you're doing it with mindfulness, there's no, well, the point, well, the deeper point is that in the Dharma, there is no such thing as right and wrong. You know, there's no duality. It's a non-dual thing. There's no one thing that's right and another thing that's wrong. Everything is a manifestation of what caused it to be. In other words, it's a manifestation of its own karma. So if you're going along and say you're feeling shame about something, right? Say you're feeling, oh, maybe you should, you know, the suggestion is to use the meditation to look at that whole notion of shame and see, well, where does that shame come from? You know, what are the karmic causes that caused you to feel shame or to feel inadequate or, you know, incompetent? And it usually goes back to something that happened, you know, in your conditioning process. You know, it's either it's a cultural conditioning process or it's a, you know, abusive relationship with a parent, or, you know, where you were not taught, you know, self-confidence, you know, self, you know, a sense of self-worth, and, you know, you were kind of taught that you were, you know, worthless and, you know, not smart, not competent, and basically psychologically abused, you know, when you were young. So you never felt a sense of your own self-worth as a person, right? You never felt acknowledged, you never felt, you know, respected, you never felt accepted as a person. Now this is powerful. I mean, this could just destroy your whole sense of self-identity. And so you act out. Either you internalize, you know, you internalize that and degrade yourself, you know, by seeing yourself as inferior or stupid or incompetent. Or you act out through acts of anger, irritation, control, you know, you start to, you know, act out against the world. But it all comes from that same, you know, that same place of, you know, conditioned inadequacy, conditioned incompetence. So if you were to be able to sit down and contemplate, you know, what were the causes of this? Why do I feel this way? You would see that there's a karmic explanation. It's something that happened in your conditioning process. And once you started to understand that, then all of a sudden you said, oh, okay, I get it. You know. So you don't have to be that way. You know, you don't have to be any way at all. Because the way you are itself is the product of specific conditioning processes. You see what I'm saying? So, you know, there are processes that go this way and that way. You know, the same thing, you could take two identical twins and put them in two different environments, and they end up being, you know, basically two different people, even though they have the same DNA and the same, you know, because it's the impact of the environment and the conditioning, you know, that affects the way they, you know, develop as people. So karma has a huge, you know, relationship to how we respond, you know, to our circumstances. So the meditation is a very powerful tool, you know, to start to unravel that, to understand that, and to, you know, come to a better relationship, you know, with who you are. So you don't have to feel shame. You don't have to feel, you know, inadequacy or self-abuse or, you know, incompetence. Because, you know, you're not. You know, you're that way because of certain conditioning patterns. But basically, we are all Buddha nature. We're all beautiful, wonderful people. If people knew you as well as you truly are, right? It goes back to, if people knew you as you truly are, you know, they would love you. Because we're all basically wonderful people. We're all basically manifestations of the divine, of Buddha nature. And this is the whole, you know, this whole process is getting back to that one epiphany, right? I'm okay. I'm okay. In spite of all the distortions and dysfunctionalities and dysfunction, you know, in my life, at heart, I'm okay. You know, I carry Buddha nature within myself. I am the Dharma. And if you can, it's like, you know, I am divine. I carry the divine spirit. I carry the Godhead within myself. And this is, you know, this is that part that unites all the wisdom traditions, you know, whether it's Judaism, Christianity, you know, Hinduism, Islam, you know, Buddhism. You carry that spark of divinity within yourself. It's just that you're so browbeaten by life that you can't see it, right? You're conditioned. So the whole process of meditation and spiritual awareness is this deconditioning. It's about deconditioning ourselves. And to see our true nature apart from all of the conditions, particularly if they tend to suppress, downgrade, and oppress us in terms of, you know, achieving our own potential, you know, and self-worth. I want to close with just one quotation. And to me, it was really, really powerful. Encapsulated for me the whole meaning of this whole process. And it was a person who was doing walking meditation on the grass. And for the first time, she felt the grass under her own feet. The first time since she was a little girl. And she just broke down and wept. It was this discovery of her body. Feeling the grass under her feet. And it was just the catharsis, that moment of awakening, that moment of perception was so powerful that it just connected her karmically back to when she was a child. And it sort of cut through all the disrespect, all the abuse, all the abandonment, all the neglect, all the wandering, you know, that she had been experiencing in her life, to that point where, you know, she could feel again what it was to be that young child. And she knew, she could see so clearly that so much of the life that she was living was a compensation for what she didn't have. So it was a life of anger, it was a life of rejection, it was a life of irritation, annoyance, control, manipulation. But it was all based on this sense of anguish, sense of abandonment that one felt. And this was this also had to do with, you know, the spiritual practice, you know, the fear of stepping out, and, you know, the need for guidance, you know, the dependency on guidance. It's almost like you need some authority figure to move you forward, you know, like some father figure. And And that's a kind of codependency, right? It's kind of like you're afraid to just put one foot in front of the other and stand on your own two feet. So, to me, this is one of the most powerful, you know, it just touched me to my heart. And it has to do with the disrespect that we experience. And I think this is something that women feel probably more than men. But it's so, for me, I was just moved to the core. It's a sense of disrespect, the sense of manipulation, being taken for granted, being used, abused, and not respected, neglected, and just, you know, kind of pushed aside. And I think, you know, probably, I'm not a woman, and I can't say that I've experienced that in my personal life, but when I hear, you know, this, you know, these stories, it just touches me to the heart, and I just feel just completely moved and touched, you know, by the honesty. And this is what I mean when I say when you get to know someone, you can't help but love them, because we see ourselves in our deep frailty, in our deep humanness, in our suffering. This is what suffering is, you know. But it's okay, you know. The whole process of awakening is seeing that suffering, you know, and then feeling that compassion for yourself. And the compassion cannot come until you see the suffering. You've got to see it. So this is the whole lesson of the whole, you know, Four Noble Truths. No, understand your own suffering, because it's only in that understanding that freedom, you know, can arise. So, thank you all very much. It was a very powerful and moving day for me, and I hope I just, at least to a fraction of the, you know, what I said, you know, can express, you know, the power that and the gratitude that I felt for what was shared with me today, you know, in the interviews. So thank you. Thank you all so much.